Far too often, battery energy storage systems are discussed as if they were giant phone batteries. You plug them in, you store some electrons, problem solved. But the reality is much more interesting. Modern batteries don't just hold power, they shape it. They smooth out the grid's irregular heartbeat. They stabilize voltage. They inject those precise bursts of electricity that keep everything humming when the weather and renewables get unpredictable. Here's the paradox. As grids take on more wind and solar without supporting technologies, they can become weaker. There's less heavy spinning machinery, the turbines that used to keep frequency stable. That's where battery systems from cells, inverters, and control systems come in. They act like finely tuned valves, managing energy flow in milliseconds. When they're used right, they act more like the brain of a new kind of grid, one that runs on precision as much as power. And that's where Gore Street Capital comes in. They're one of the funds proving that large-scale energy storage isn't a science project anymore. It's global infrastructure. The company now operates across multiple markets and regions in Great Britain, Ireland, Germany, Texas, California, and Japan. As of mid-2025, their portfolio totals more than 1.25 gigawatts of rated power. That's around the power of a traditional gas-fired power station spread across the globe, where the lessons learned in each of those grids is shaping how they scale. Our guest today is Alicia. She leads Gore Street's engineering and asset management team, taking projects from development through to construction and managing operations day to day. She's an engineer by training and makes sure these assets actually work. Under her watch, Gore Street has grown from being a UK pioneer into being a truly global operator. In California, they've built Big Rock, a 200 megawatt, 4-hour system that keeps the grid reliable through long-term contracts while still trading short-term energy. In Texas, they started small, learning the quirks of the market before scaling up. And in Britain and Ireland, they're now upgrading some of their early, shorter duration batteries, adding more energy capacity to stretch out performance. And Gore Street isn't stopping there. They've launched Japan's first dedicated energy storage fund and are expanding across Europe. This is a key element of the energy transition, as firms like Gore Street are making that shift bankable, repeatable, and global. So, welcome back to Transmission. Hello, Alicia, and welcome to Transmission.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
And as ever, let's start off with who are you and who are Gore Street Capital?
Sure. So maybe I'll start with Gore Street Capital and then we'll move to me. So Gore Street Capital started as a fund manager specializing really in renewables. We figured out pretty quickly there's a lot of renewable investors, and we felt we need something, a different vehicle of investment that will provide kind of a more specialized, a more tailored and needed asset class. And that's how basically Alex and the team arrived at energy storage. We really truly focus only on energy storage. We're technology agnostic. And I think we probably are sort of moving more towards IPP now. We have a big technical team with lots of engineers and data scientists. With outsourced balance sheet, we don't own the assets. We manage funds. And my role is really some engineer by background, and I manage a team that looks after the portfolio, but that's kind of development, construction services, procurement, and operational. So we really look after the assets from start of their life. Well, hopefully not to the grave, because we haven't seen any of the assets decommissioned. But yeah, we basically take off the whole life cycle, and we, you know, see the good, the bad, and the ugly of decisions that we make.
And I'm really excited to get into some of those details around some of the nuance of different assets by different locations. You mentioned IPP. What's an IPP?
So independent power producer, obviously that is someone who holds assets and takes full ownership of the asset. In a way, we have a mandate to manage our portfolio. We have two funds at the moment. GSF fund, it's a listed entity that IPO'd in 2018. It has assets in 5 markets. We make commercial decisions for those assets. That's our mandate, but we feel like these are our assets. We feel very responsible for them, and they've been with us since the beginning of our kind of existence as a company. But it also means that we have technical capability in-house. We have people who understand construction, trading. We have an in-house trading team and people who are really excellent asset management, and they understand how the project has to function.
Okay. And we last had Gorstry on transmission back in May 2024. We had Alex on, and he was talking about building this global energy storage fund. What's changed since then?
So I think lots has changed. We are actively now managing two funds. So at the time we already had Japan fund, and we're looking kind of towards new directions as well. We're looking towards EU as a next step. But definitely we spend the last sort of 3 years, roughly from 2023, really focusing on deployment. So we did a number of very successful capital raises before 2023. And then we focus really on deploying capital. And that construction deployment campaign has been immense in effort because it involved building assets in California, building assets in Texas. And that was complex, but also, you know, resource intensive, but also, you know, the time difference. So, you know, it's been something that definitely changed us as a company. We became a kind of deploying machine, and we also had to find the right resources of people, partners on the ground, so that we can deliver something that is on a different continent, 8 hours behind us.
Well, let's talk in a second about some of that approach to finding partners and making sure you have the right partners for the right locations. But first, just to give people a kind of concept of sizes and locations. So what were the typical sizes that you looked at for those regions? And was that all kind of all in one go, or is that across multiple sites?
Sure. So I think every market is different. So we never have a kind of a completely cookie cutter approach to finding markets and then finding assets in those markets. I guess what is maybe always true for every market when we look for new places to deploy is the fundamentals have to be there. So renewables have to be there. There has to be a strong conviction that renewables are going to be in the mix and they're there to stay. And also the policy is that people who decide on the policy, they understand the need for flexibility. And obviously, California, Texas were places where it was clear that this is true. Both have, you know, Texas is maybe counterintuitive because it's such an oil and gas place, but it has a huge amount of renewables. It has solar, it has wind, it's constrained, and it has basically the need for flexibility. And it has also quite an aging asset class and aging network, which sort of very much demonstrated itself in 2023 with very high revenues there. California, similar, different model because they sort of think about market about differently. They have sort of equivalent of capacity market. California is, you know, a typical example of a place where flexibility is used well and required and supported by policy. So yeah, it was no brainer. Okay. Finding assets was definitely a process, and you know, investment team is very well placed through our partners, through kind of relationship from banking space. We have partners to help us find the right deals.
Okay, and how did you pick the sizes? So did you go for sort of 5 megawatts, 50 megawatts, 500 megawatts? How did you end up at the sizes that you have for those assets?
So I think again, kind of market by market. I think in California, generally, you have a dominantly large assets. It's economy of scale. Of course, economy of scale means that if you build a 200 megawatt asset, inherently it will be cheaper per megawatt, will be cheaper per megawatt hour. Mm-hmm. And California allows for that. So that's how we landed at Big Rock. In Texas, it was a staged approach. It was the first geography in the US we went to. So we entered with smaller to be able to kind of learn and understand US and Jenny kind of get teeth into the market. So we started with 9.9 megawatt assets. Which were operational, and then we acquired Dogfish, and Dogfish, with its very special name, is a 75 megawatt asset. And it's, again, kind of the right balance between kind of risk allocation in that market, but also economy of scale.
And Big Rock, did you say how big that is?
Big Rock is 200 megawatts. Okay. Basically, 2-hour system. California has that specificity that they require geographically load serving entities, so people who sell electricity to people, to have a certain amount of generation, to procure a certain amount of generation to basically serve the security of the system. And we have secured sort of half of our battery to be able to supply that service. It's called resource adequacy. So it requires 4 hours. Therefore, our battery is basically half of it is serving that resource adequacy contract.
Okay, makes sense. And I think I need to get my sort of helmet on in a second because I'm going to say something that is almost certainly a red rag to a bull. Would you say that batteries in new markets just plug and play?
No, I've heard it many times from people, and it's one of those things that makes me laugh and also gets me a little bit, I guess, you know, a little bit grumpy. No, batteries do appear like they're plug and play because of how they look like. Obviously, they, you know, when you look at them, they don't look like a complex machine like, you know, wind turbines or pumped hydro, but they are complex because of how you monetize them. They're complex how you integrate them into the grid. Construction itself can be challenging for sure, but the complexity really comes through. These are not machines, or, you know, these are not technologies that you plug and they just export energy. They do, as you know, lots of clever things. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a portfolio of services. So to be able to integrate that asset into the grid is so much more than plug and play.
And that complexity is kind of increasing. So in the sort of first instance of batteries coming into a grid, maybe you looked at, say, frequency response, and yeah. then you sort of move into energy trading, energy arbitrage.
Yeah.
Then you've kind of got this new suite of services coming through. Maybe there's voltage control, maybe from a grid-forming inverter. And so you sort of have this additional challenge coming through. So how have you been finding that process in terms of bringing on some of these more complicated sites?
Sure. So I think that's a really interesting point that, you know, as the market and the sector matures, system operators learn about the value that assets bring. So they start to procure more and more complex, they become more adventurous with services that they're getting from batteries. I, you know, remember all the way back in 2019 when we started deploying in Ireland, system operator truly didn't know how batteries work. They didn't fully kind of, and it's fair because they didn't have batteries on their system, so they didn't fully get the state of charge, the ramping, the speed of response, all the characteristics that the batteries exhibit. And now we're in this space where it's been proven, it's proven to work, it has stabilized a number of events, both in GB, in Ireland, in other more mature markets. Mm. So yes, we're moving into a space where, you know, you're procuring or selling as a battery owner, you're selling inertia, you're selling reactive power, but also you are selling into increasingly renewable grid, which means that those grids are weaker by nature. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to profess to be an electrical engineer, but it's well understood that basically if you increase number of or amount of renewable generation, you're creating a weaker grid. Mm. And therefore, your ability to control your asset and be able to provide a compliant response becomes so much harder. Harder because you need to really understand the fault levels that you will be connecting to. So you need to really get the right data from network operator, system operator to model it well. Mm. You need to prove that your system will be compliant and not causing voltage oscillations or deviations from the compliant response. And then on top of that, you probably want to be doing more than just grid compliance. You probably want to be selling services, which means that your battery has to be really, really well understood from control mm. perspective. I think we probably maybe don't appreciate how much this will be a challenge going forward to build assets, you know, tertiary connections, co-located batteries, mm-hmm. weak grids like in Scotland. You know, it's not just plug and play, use the typical settings for inverters. It's now about like really tailoring your response and having a very good integration and good control.
Yes, I totally agree. I think maybe one thing I would add is that sometimes when we talk about these markets, we talk about a battery providing some of those sort of system services, when in reality, quite often that comes from the inverter. We seem to forget about the inverter that's kind of the forgotten middleman of this whole transaction.
Yeah, the sort of least expensive, no one gets excited, but the brain of the operation.
Actually, it's a lot of how this all works. And so sometimes when I have a sort of conversation, we start talking about, say, like just for example, voltage control. People say, oh, batteries can do this. Batteries, actually, it's not really the battery that's doing that. The battery's providing some energy, yeah. but in reality, this is actually the inverter tech,
yeah.
Which is the fun part.
I mean, it's a funny one because the water analogy always is used actually when you teach electrical that, you know, water is basically the battery is the water in the bucket, while the inverter is the valve, and the valve is what controls the flow. And we see much more complicated than a simple valve. But yeah, that's how you can think about.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
You just touched on it there. So you talked about Ireland a little bit, and then you also talked about GB. So we've talked about new sites and how you're sort of looking across those. Let's talk about the old sites. So how are you thinking about all of the sites that you already have, and how do you want to change those sites to improve them?
Yeah, we made a very conscious decision, probably kind of around 2022, maybe 2021, that we're not going to follow the... There was kind of a massive push at the time to do 2 hours. And everyone was saying, let's do 2 hours because it's the right time. And we were kind of very, I think, kind of more cautious. And we held back and we didn't. So most of our portfolio in GB is around 1 hour. In Ireland, actually, one of most successful geographies, you would not believe, but it's a 21-minute systems. I don't think anyone manufactures those C-rates anymore. And most of our portfolio is kind of on the shorter duration, apart from obviously US projects. We're definitely seeing that this is shifting, and it's the right time to shift because of the prices, because of the learning curve of batteries. And it's the right time to deploy now. I think if you compare the time when people build to our systems, a lot of people build in GB around 2022 is when the battery prices were at its highest. Mm-hmm. And probably the spread between 1 hour, 2 hours wasn't as prominent now. Clearly, we're moving to more renewable grids where, you know, the times of low prices are increasing. So you have longer durations of low prices and you have this bigger grab. You just need longer duration batteries. So we are actively looking now to augment some of our sites. We knew that this period will come when we will want to increase duration, and we designed the systems to be able to do it. So we're actually actively augmenting 2 sites, preparing for augmentation of 2 sites in GB, Stony and Ferrymuir, 80 megawatts and 50 megawatts. And it's a DC augmentation. It's the easiest augmentation to do because you're just adding energy. You're not changing inverters. You're not adding anything that changes your grid behavior, which means that you are avoiding any retesting of your grid code compliance. It's okay. A low risk.
Okay. Augmentation. So the inverter stays the same. A stupid question, but things like the foundations, are you able to say swap one 20-foot container for another 20-foot container?
Yeah. So basically we've already kind of pre-designed this with Nidec so that the foundations are effective. There's a space for foundations, and we'll move some of the cells around so that obviously you're kind of not mixing old and new cells. So we'll move cells around behind the same lineup, behind the same inverter, free up inverters and bring new cells. Okay. It's kind of very low risk kind of campaign.
And I suppose one of the other things that's changed is also the energy density, right?
Yes.
So instead of having less energy dense systems, you can now kind of fit more energy onto the same footprint. Do you find that you need more footprint with the augmentation, or are you able to sort of shift around the space that you've got and then be able to get in the augmented energy into the same size footprint?
I think it's actually probably more efficient in that sense that, you know, a 20-foot container now can fit around 7 megawatt hours. So you definitely can fit more within the space that you have now. So you can augment sites now probably beyond what you could think of even in 2022. It's been a step change definitely in the product.
And I think one of the really interesting things from our side, and we look a lot at augmentation, we look a lot at forecasting, and like, what is the right duration for a battery? That question comes up a million times. And the interesting answer in GB is that it kind of depends a little bit. So the revenue numbers can be quite, not flat, but the choice between, say, a 2 hour and a 6 hour system really depends on what the sort of capex comes through. And so this is something where like the supply chain really matters, and I think there's it's really interesting to see sort of how different groups with different supply chains can make different decisions. There's not a perfect answer, which is it has to be 2.7
Absolutely.
hours. It really does depend on kind of what comes through from your capex side. Okay. And so we've done new sites, we've done augmentation, and you mentioned very briefly you looked at Japan.
We did. Yeah.
Would you like to just give me a quick overview of the sort of Japanese business model?
So just as a background, so Core Street paired and basically kind of created a JV with Itochu. It's a large trading house in Japan, and we were selected by Tokyo government around 2023 to start the first pure play energy storage fund in Japan, which was amazing. The rationale why Japan is looking into batteries, and they're quite behind the curve, to be honest, when you compare them to other markets. That's why I think the growth will be significant. Well, one of the first things is that they import 70% of their electricity in terms of fossil fuels from outside, and that creates a security risk for them. And that was something that definitely drove the decision to bring renewables and obviously kind of become independent. I'm sure they see the Chinese dominance in lithium ion a bit as a risk as well. And they have a huge industrial background in terms of the companies like Panasonic and Sony that could benefit from the battery growth. So I think there are fundamentals that make complete sense, that Japan is actively supporting battery growth, and not just batteries in terms of deployment, but also being able to scale the industrial sector off the back of the growth.
And just on that, Japan is like one of the surprising growth stories of the last few years.
That's
it's forever
right.
been
slow
seen to be stagnated. To be slow and steady. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And now we're starting to see movement in Japan. So definitely an interesting sort of story that's running alongside the power market.
Definitely. And it's one where I would acknowledge that having a Japanese partner is a must. There is a language barrier for sure, but there's also just an inherent knowledge of the market that I think it's harder to break into as an outsider. So being partnered with Itochu was critical for us. And it's not without challenges that, you know, market has got different frequencies. One side is 50 hertz, the other one is 60 hertz. The licensing, the policy is still being shaped. So there are risks. But again, early movers.
Yeah, and we don't have time for the two islands in Japan having different frequency
and
story.
Why is that? Yeah,
but definitely take a look at it. That's a really fun, quirky part of power markets. Okay, so you're sort of juggling Japan, California, Texas, UK, Ireland, all at the same time.
Yeah, the time differences are not merciful.
Not merciful. Well, why not? Let's throw in a new market. Let's look at the EU. At least it's in the middle. Okay, averages out. So for the EU, how much are you looking at the EU, and which markets stand out to you?
We definitely are looking at EU. This is the next massive focus for us. We hope to close fund by the end of the year that will be dedicated to EU27. I'm personally very excited about it because it makes the time difference easier. Honestly, I'm just so happy that we wouldn't have to spend 8 hours, waiting for people to come online. But also generally, I think Europe is overdue with batteries. I think they woke up a bit late. But at least when they woke up, it was clear that EU is going to put, all the sort of effort and policy and just rally everyone behind. Okay, we need energy storage. You can take your different flavors nationally, but, deploy, and we'll create Picasso, we'll create Mari, so that ancillary services platforms, so you can trade across geographies. We will look at the markets that we know somewhat from GSF. But we also look at new markets, and one which is obviously very close to my heart, Poland. We will definitely still look at Ireland. This will be our core market, and I think Ireland is still very much an exciting market for batteries. They just launched a consultation for LDES, for long duration storage. I had a privilege to speak to CEO of Ergrid a few weeks ago, and I asked him all the difficult questions. I asked him if he believes in storage, if he thinks that, short duration storage has a place, long duration. All the answers were very positive. He generally is very convinced about storage, so that's also positive. Germany is definitely one we will look into. I think, Germany, again, huge growth area. It has its challenges. I think the grid is a big challenge in Germany, figuring out the curtailment, the big BKZ costs is tricky, but we have an asset in Germany, and it's been a very, very steady state performing asset from revenue perspective, and the fundamentals are there. Germany has a very deep intraday market, imbalances penalized, so there's lots of basically trading happening there. And then last but not least, for now, we're definitely looking actively in Poland. I'm Polish, so I'm very happy about this. Also, the burden of translating all the Polish documents, or at least helping AI, you know, kind of to get the full granularity of what those documents mean, falls on me, but that's fine. And the rationale why this is happening in Poland is kind of the same as everyone else. Poland is, again, behind the curve in renewable integration. There starts to be a significant amount of solar and wind on Polish markets, about 30 gigs, which is about 30 to 40%. And it's meant to grow much more because we will have offshore wind in the north of Poland. But what is great is that it's clear that the national system operator recognizes, again, the value of batteries. And I was listening to the CEO of Polish SO about a month ago at a conference in Warsaw, and he was speaking about batteries in a way that makes my heart grow.
Okay, very good.
He was definitely acknowledging, you know, that this is a system, this is an asset class they need. They want to create products that will enable investment. He was talking about accelerating grid connections for batteries. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what you want to hear.
I think there's an element, you said that Europe was somehow sort of second to this, or just like slow in waking up. I think it's maybe not the worst thing in the world, actually. Mm-hmm. In some senses, if you bought all of your batteries back in 2021, 2022, you might have like locked in some very high prices. Actually, if you're slightly slow to wake up, but when you wake up, you're in a world where you can get a system for $100 per kilowatt
exactly.
hour, then actually you may have been sort of sleeping at the wheel, so to speak, but actually you might have
And you inherit all the lessons.
In terms of being able to, you don't have to think about a 5 megawatt site. There's a 2 gigawatt blueprint if you want to go and get it. And so you can actually sort of refurb some of your old coal sites and move very quickly. In a sort of hosting capacity, you went very quickly through Picasso, Mari and BKZ.
Yeah, that's probably a lot.
Would you like to just give one line on each of them?
So Picasso and Mari, those are, you know, platforms that allow people to basically trade ancillary services across Europe. I think they're only starting in some places. I think Poland just literally integrated with Picasso a few months ago. I don't think it's super well established, but it also allows you to take a view that you're not trading in a kind of smaller market, which is just Polish market. You're kind of accessing the whole requirement in other geographies, but also you're competing with more batteries. But generally, it allows for a more efficient use of energy mm-hmm. across the continent. And I think it's great. It makes sense.
Never underestimate the EU's ability to make an acronym that spells something they want it to spell.
Yeah. Yeah. Picasso, that is a serious effort. I don't for even sure. know what it stands for. I'm
like, BKZ, less exciting. Yeah. But what is BKZ, very quickly?
I mean, BKZ, basically, I think it's trying to explain the costs that you as a battery owner will be kind of charged by the network operator to build out your grid connection. And what I understood, and we are still kind of figuring it out, is that those costs can make and break a battery. And Absolutely. They're meant to be changing. They're looking at reforming it. But definitely one that if you're looking at Germany, understand what it is, because it can make and break the business case.
Yeah. And we have there's a Modo Energy free explainer on BKZ. If anyone is keen to find out more and see sort of a map of what the charges are, that's on the Modo terminal, which is a fun thing to go and take a look at. Let's come back to Poland. You mentioned offshore wind is coming. You mentioned sort of solar as well. When I think of Poland, I think of coal.
Yes.
And so would you like to just kind of quickly describe what the demand looks like, what the traditional generation looks like, and perhaps why that makes it so appealing?
Yeah. So basically, majority of generation in Poland was historically coal-based. I mean, this is just historical reasons. We used to have coal production of our own. Now it's immensely expensive, non-economical. We actually used to import coal, shockingly, from Russia, which obviously comes with its own, you know, geopolitical challenges. There is a very strong realization that A, this is non-viable, and the carbon cost of this is completely not, you know, fit for the future. Most of wind generation and solar is located in the north, so it creates also kind of transmission challenges for system operator. Also kind of a major kind of industrial push is coming from the effort to build offshore wind off the coast of Baltic, which I think is a great idea because it's a shallow water with good wind resource, so kind of perfect to build offshore. And I think the first sites are coming online pretty quickly in the next sort of three, four years. So there's a challenge. There's a transmission challenge, and there is a challenge around the growth of demand because all the heating system is CHP, so central combined heat and power. When you go to Poland, you can see everywhere those big stacks, basically chimneys, which provide heat and they provide power. That has to go because again, it's mostly coal. So there will be a transition in heating to electrification. There will be electrification of transport and also metalworks. You know, we produce a lot of metal in some parts of Poland that will be electrified. So therefore, you have a huge push for demand electrification, and that, you know, with renewables just creates, you know, the typical challenges that batteries can solve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so when, if I was to say, what year would we expect to see Gore Street in Poland with an asset live?
I'm hoping that we will start deploying 2026 and those assets will be live in 2027. If I can take what the CEO of the system operator is saying, that he will enable people to connect sooner, than I'm hoping in 2027 those assets will be live.
Yeah, and this is just broadly, it's just a really exciting thing to see in terms of the expertise that's coming from the GB power sector and battery sector coming through, going to Texas, going to California, going to Japan, going to Poland. I think this is one of the things that maybe people don't appreciate, that there has sort of been a big export of knowledge and know-how from the UK as a system. Yes. That I think we should be very proud of as a sector.
Absolutely. When you go to conference in Poland, it's almost like you feel you go to Energy Storage Summit in London. It's just the same, you know, the same faces. It's quite surprising.
Very good. And so one more topic. So you mentioned LDES earlier, so long duration energy storage. You mentioned it in the context of Ireland, but obviously it's been a very topical conversation in GB for a while now. How does Gore Street see the long-duration storage cap and floor scheme?
Sure. So we have an asset in cap and floor scheme. It has kind of pre-qualified. We're in this next stage of submitting. I think it's 18th of November. I think it's something that we see as a natural progression of the asset class. The fact that Ofgem realized that there needs to be support to roll out longer duration, I think it's the right thing. I agree that I would very much like not to see that LDES with contracted, you know, floor cannibalizes ancillary services and therefore penalizes the shorter duration batteries on which the industry was built. Mm-hmm. I know that fairness is not always the thing in the market, but I think you have to recognize that on the basis of those 1 hour, 2 hour batteries, you build a cost curve and you build learning curve. So you have to protect those early investments as well. And I'm going to leave it to policymakers to decide how to make sure that you do not cannibalize and suffocate those that cannot be 8 hour systems. But I also think that there needs to be a growth curve for longer duration. And I also support the fact that we should be building other asset classes alongside lithium. That lithium is the right choice for quick deployment now. It's very mature, very cost efficient, very de-risked as much as a technology can be. You can deploy it in 12 months. So Big Rock in California, we built in 12 months, 200 megawatt asset. And that's a stepping change to have LDES on the system. But I also think that we need other technologies to come behind it, because you need longer duration, more than 10, 12 hours. So I think it's the right thing. But yes, there are challenges with obviously how this is going to create an uneven playing field.
Yes. Just as a side note, the industry has a history in terms of, if a change is made in one part of the sector and that means there's a negative impact on another asset that's kind of already deployed, you kind of get this concept of missing money. So an existing investment is now missing money effectively. And when we've made changes in the past, the people have thought, okay, well, great, we can make this change, but also we need to recognize that we're having a negative impact on this other part of the sector. And so they kind of go through this process of saying, well, look, how much money is that? And in the spirit of fairness, as you were saying, can you kind of make people whole and make sure that there's kind of a good environment for investors to come and keep deploying capital?
Exactly, because it can happen in 5 years to, yeah.
Exactly.
You can't keep on repeating the same sort of...
The one thing you don't want to have happen is investors to lose confidence in the space and not want to come and invest in storage in GB. Okay, really interesting. I think the point as well around kind of lithium is that technology of the moment, but let's keep the markets open, keep the markets fair, so that if the next thing that comes through isn't lithium or is a different form of lithium, whatever it might be, we're in a position to take advantage of it rather than kind of locking down for a particular techs. I think that would be madness. Okay, so one final question then before I move on to the two questions that we always come to at the end. The last question is, with the funds over the last year or so, we've seen some interesting news stories coming through. I suppose one of them that stands out is Harmony Energy Income Trust was picked up by Foresight. How do you think about that as a sort of development?
Sure. I think it was, you know, overall a positive story. The actual, I guess, transaction happened on the back of some of the troubles that obviously Harmony have had. But overall, obviously, what it delivered validation of value, those assets sold at what basically the underwriting was, which is very positive. Whether we saw a translation to us directly immediately off the back of it, no, we didn't. We didn't see our share price kind of come to NAV. But I think there are more, you know, factors to play in the reason why there is such a persistent discount. And I think a lot of people, clever people, have been scratching their heads why that persistent discount is there. There are macroeconomic factors which we can explain, but different trusts have different flavors. And I think that discount is kind of not behaving always very rationally. Mm-hmm. But we're, you know, we have our plan. We're doing the things that we always said to the market, and we follow through. And we hope that, you know, the market will kind of recover off the back of the consistency and the rational thinking that we're trying to put out there, so that it becomes less emotional decision and more about, you know, what is the cash flow, what is the dividend cover, what's the, you know, promises that have been made around augmentation and delivery of certain transactions that the investors want to see. But, you know, we'll see what the future brings.
Interesting space. And if you were after fund analytics, I'm afraid this wasn't going to be the podcast for you. I think just when you take a step back from it, both for the other funds, but also for sort of other valuations in the space, I think that Harmony transaction was a pretty notable one
for
the wider space, and definitely in terms of reinforcing those valuations. A pretty interesting transaction. Okay, then on to the final two questions. So is there anything, firstly, that you would like to plug?
Anything else I want to plug? No, I think, you know, it's been tough couple of years, I would think. You know, we've seen a lot of, not the first saturation in GB, but we've seen kind of, you know, a saturation in around 2020, of the back of 2023, 24. I think we're riding through this now, and I think we're seeing a more consistent value that is not driven by saturation of ancillary services. We're seeing a massive sophistication of products that will be acquired. So I'm very positive about the space, and I'm happy that GB is leading that front, that, you know, we are setting the standards for others. Definitely Poland, for example, is doing lots of things looking into GB. So I'm very positive, and I look forward to other sort of technologies coming into play. I think Sodium is the one to watch. So yeah, definitely, you know, more exciting time for the sector.
Okay, very exciting. And then on the final part, is there a contrarian view you hold?
I don't know if it's a contrarian view, but I potentially kind of touched upon it a bit earlier when we spoke about some of the challenges. I think I do see that. I think we are slightly underappreciating the complexity of the network that we will be. We're trying to solve renewable energy. I don't want to say it's not a problem, the nature of renewable energy grid, by having flexible, fast-acting, clever assets. But I think we really have to appreciate how complex that network will be. And this is both on the side of generation, so people who actually own assets, so they understand how to run the process early in time to really identify what kind of grid they're dealing with. And also on the side of integrators, controllers, people who really build those assets, I think that sort of sophistication has to come in. But also I see a massive challenge from NISO perspective and people who actually connect the batteries, to have resources and time to truly, I think, model what's getting connected, and, you know, speeding up that process. I don't think it should take 2 years or 2.5 years to connect a battery from the moment you start design to the moment it's energized. I think it should be more like 12. And, I think at the moment it's more multiple years.
And so I suppose to kind of wrap that view up, it's almost that the connections process and the uniformity of the grid is something that you'd almost do away with the concept that the grid is like totally uniform. Actually, each individual connection is going to be special or bespoke, and even though that does exist, you still think we could actually be doing a lot of this connection much faster.
I think so, and I think, you know, someone once said to me, and I think it's very true, we build the easy connections. I think the ones that are coming into play now will be harder. That's why there is such a massive push for, you know, we have scarcity of grid connections, and that the ones we're now looking to deploy will be harder. So I think just much more sophistication will be needed.
Yeah, fascinating. Alicia, thank you very much for coming on Transmission. You've been a wonderful guest. And I hope that listeners have learned as much as I have from that conversation.
Thank you very much.